So we're reading from Revelation 17. Last week we looked at the seven bowls of God's wrath, and we went through six of them, and this is the seventh one. So last week we looked at how God's wrath is actually good news for the world. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This was the title written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come." This calls for a mind of wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received the kingdom, but who are for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his followers, chosen and faithful followers. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God has put into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw in the great city that rules over the kings of the earth."
Thanks, Kim. It'd be helpful to keep a Bible open at Revelation 17, 18 if you've got one, and there's an outline on the back of the newsletter, if that's helpful for you. 2 years ago in New York, the Occupy Wall Street protests flooded that city and our TV screens. Do you remember it? Groups of people coming together to protest against the corrupting influence of big business on government. And the anger that was, I think, suppressed, that many people around the world felt, started to boil over. And it spread from New York to most of the other major cities in the world, including Australia. I guess it came in the wake of the global financial crisis, which exposed a system in which the rich just kept getting richer, even as billions of people were forced into increased poverty by the greed of those people. And most of us, I hope you included, got angry as you saw what was happening around the world, when you saw banking institutions collapse, and yet the people actually causing that walking away with millions in bonuses. And as that was happening, people all around the world were slipping into poverty and degradation. It sparked those sort of protests against globalisation and the widening gap between rich and poor and the collusion between government and business that supported it. Now, as you saw that, I don't know how you reacted. Maybe you were only 16 at the time and you thought, that's out of my league, I don't know what to do about it. But did you feel some of the anger that corruption in the world can do that sort of thing to people's lives? That people in their greed and rapaciousness can just, without compunction, cause millions of people to go into poverty? Some of us, I guess, might think, but I trust big business. We naively think that the only thing they're out to do is increase the lifespan of people on the world, that they're some sort of benevolent society. Well, let me tell you, they're not. Or maybe you think, but I trust governments. Well, if you've been to anywhere like Africa in any of your life, you'll know not to trust governments. Corruption at government level is rife. It's rife around the world, not just Africa. Indonesia, our nearest neighbour. The nepotism and the corruption in Indonesia it's world-renowned. People do all sorts of things to try and stamp it out, and it just goes on and on and on from power to power. Maybe you think, it's not Australia, though. Well, we've just had a commission into the Obeid affair in New South Wales that has exposed corruption, where millions of dollars have gone into the pockets of politicians and developers, their mates, taken other people down. You might think, but it's too big to tackle. I can't do anything about it. And so we sink into that apathy. No, well, my life's fine. It's not affecting me. I'll just go on with things. Maybe you did think of joining the protests. Be out there. Express some of your anger at the corruption of the world. But the trouble is, for many of us, the very people we might be protesting about are the people we want to get jobs with. Who will give you jobs when you finish uni? It's big business, isn't it? It's the corporations. How can you protest against them if you want a job with them? And so maybe you felt compromised. They are the people who you depend on for your career and income to live the dream that you want to live. Revelation chapter 17 and 18 are helpful chapters for us because they expose that corruption, the corruption of governments and business, the collusion between them, and talks about their destiny. An angel says to John, come and I'll show you the sights of the world. In the context of the book of Revelation, Revelation is really about seeing behind world events to what's really the reality behind them. And we just watch it go past on our TV screens, but it's hard to know what is really happening. What is the forces behind it? Revelation opens our eyes to that because John is shown, back in chapter 4 and 5, he's shown that even though the world looks a confusing mess, God is on the throne in heaven. It's his world. And he's entrusted the rule of the world to the Lamb who was slain, who's breaking the seals of God's purposes for the world and bringing them about. And if you've been with us over the last couple of years, sorry if you're first year, this is a bit difficult, isn't it? We've been through Revelation chapters 1 to 16. We've seen the seven seals and the seven trumpets, the seven bowls, these cycles of suffering, of cause and effect, of God's judgment and God's grace poured out on this world. In chapters 12 to 14, we saw something behind that, the dragon, who is Satan, the force, the spiritual force of evil, who has two beasts who come out of the sea. One of them is political power. The other is false religion. And the three together are sort of parody of the Trinity, the dragon, the beast, B1 and B2. Chapter 16, we saw the completion of God's wrath in the bowls. Now John is shown an important detail about one of the principal characters, the great prostitute. And so he's shown this woman, this prostitute, who's riding on a beast. The woman is all gaudy. She's dressed in gold. She's got all sorts of gold. She's got purple robes, which isn't the slinky sexiness of a prostitute, but the opulence of power. She's on a beast, who's an unusual beast, not told much about the beast, scarlet, covered with blasphemies, but it's got seven heads and 10 horns. Hard to imagine, isn't it? How do you get 10 horns on seven heads? Some of them got two, some of them got... But that's what it's like. If you know the book of Revelation, it'll take you straight back to chapter 13, verse 1, because the beast, the first beast that comes out of the sea, has seven heads and 10 horns, representing political power and domination, the superpowers of the world. But the beast, although it looks powerful, is just a puppet of the dragon, of Satan. And this woman is riding on the beast. She's in league with the beast. The woman is called Babylon the Great. She's a woman, but she's actually a city, a great city. Now, cities are ambiguous things, I think, for many of us. I mean, some of us are country people. We hate the city. We can't get out of here soon enough. But for most of us, cities are attractive. They've got that allure of wealth, of energy, of things happening. But they've also got at the core of them that opulence and decadence and corruption and degradation. Perth's like that, isn't it? New York's like that. Sydney's like that. Paris is like that. London's like that. Every city in the world has that two sides to it. This one, this is the negative side that's shown to us, the essence and source of prostitution, of abomination. Not sexual prostitution, but political and power. And she's drunk with the blood of the saints. She's a persecutor of God's people. But in chapter 17, it's the beast that gets most of the attention and the explanation, the complex details. The seven heads, we're told, are seven hills. But there are also seven kings, a double symbolism. The ten horns are ten other kings. And then in a strange twist in verses 16 to 18, the beast turns against the woman. We're told it's God's purpose, God's plan. He brings it about. And yet the kings, the beasts, want to do that. And the woman is brought to ruin. This prostitute, Babylon the Great. The path may be complex, heads and horns and alliances, but the end is the critical detail. She is ruined. Well, if chapter 17 shows us the characters, chapter 18, we see more of the action. After this, I saw another angel, chapter 18, verse 1, coming down from heaven. He had great authority and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. This is a great heavenly angel. And then with a mighty voice, it's what he says that counts, fallen, fallen, is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling for demons, a haunt for every impure spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird and detestable animal. All the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her. The merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. Fallen. It's like the prophets of the Old Testament who look ahead, who are shown by God what is going to happen, and so they proclaim it. They shout from the mountaintops, this is what... Well, it actually says fallen, even though it's looking to the future. It will fall. I know it will fall. God has shown me it will fall. Therefore, I can say fallen, as if it's already happened. And this city, this woman, gets her just deserts. In verses 4 to 8, her sins are piled up to heaven. The stench of them is in God's nostrils. And he gives to her as much torment as the luxuries she's extracted from others at expense to them. She boasts of her royalty and her security. She's immune from mourning, she says. I'll never mourn. Everything's going to just keep going forever and ever and ever. Therefore, she will mourn as she deserves to. And then in verses 9 through to 20, we see the reaction of the other significant players on the world scene. Her doom leads to the mourning and lament and terror. Firstly, of the kings, verse 9, when the kings of the earth who've committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn, terrified at her torment. They'll stand far off and cry, woe, woe to you, great city, you mighty city of Babylon. In 1 hour, your doom has come. See, they've got into bed with her. And when she falls, they fall. Their wealth and luxury come from her and their allegiance with her. When she falls, it all disappears. It goes up in flames. Verse 11, the business tycoons, the merchants of the earth, will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones, all those sorts of things. The trade just finishes. With her destruction, the bottom drops out of the market. They've made fortunes out of smoozing up with her, but when she was strong, they partied. But now they are ruined. The tears stream down their faces. Verse 17, the transport moguls, every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors, all who earn their living by the sea will stand far off. That is, all those who've made their fortunes by tapping into the trade that gravitated to this great city, they're devastated. Their party is over as well. With the ruin of Babylon, they are ruined. And finally, in verses 21 to 24, the destruction of Babylon herself is described. A mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone, often 7-10 metres across, and threw it into the sea. You can imagine the scene, can't you? Somebody picking up a great boulder and just throwing it into the sea. And what does it do? Well, great huge splash. And what happens to the boulder? Glug, glug, glug. Down to the bottom. And the angel says, with such violence the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. Music of harpists and musicians will never be heard. No worker will ever be found in you again. The sound of the millstone of productivity will never be heard. Your merchants were the world's important people. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of the prophets and of God's holy people, all who have been slaughtered on the earth. This is how she will be thrown down, violently, quickly, never again. She thought she was permanent, but she'll be permanently destroyed. And all the corruption, all the exploitation that she's been at the heart of, that were her trademark, are ended forever. The violence, the persecution are gone from God's world. Well, that's the story. That's the picture. That's what John is showing. What does it all mean? Because if you're like me, you read that and think, well, that's pretty pictures. I can make a movie of it. But what on earth does it mean? The passage is mainly about the prostitute, this woman who's a city, Babylon the Great, and her end. But who is she? Well, the book of Revelation is full of cryptic symbolism, sort of like our political cartoons are. Now, you see a political cartoon with an eagle, and you know who that is, don't you? Hope you do anyway. That's America. A bear? Well, that's something else. But the key for most of the book of Revelation is the Old Testament. So many things in the book of Revelation sound like things out of the Old Testament, which if you know your Old Testament, makes it terrific, because you can understand it. If you don't, makes it a bit more difficult. You need commentaries to tell you where to get it from, or look up your cross-references. Babylon the Great. Because in the Old Testament, Babylon the Great is a well-known identity. Its image first comes to prominence in Genesis chapter 11. Remember the Tower of Babel? The Tower of Babylon, out there on the plains of Shinar. And humanity comes together to build a tower to the heavens. It's human capacities at their best and their worst at the same time. Humans get together using their technology and ingenuity, using their wealth and cooperation to build a world without God, to reach heaven in defiance of God. It's the first multinational corporation. That's what it is. But God's response is not to say, hey, well done, but to damn it, to make that corporate effort as difficult as it could ever be by confusing their languages and scattering them over the face of the world. Genesis 11, the first instance. Second one is 7th century before Christ, 7th century BC, where after some other empires, the Babylonian Empire rises to be the superpower of the day. The wealthiest, most powerful force there's ever been up to that time. But it's adulterous, it's sophisticated, and it's corrupt. And in that world, when Babylon has got the power, when that city is the centre of everything in the world, if you wanted to survive, if you wanted to prosper, what did you do? Well, you fell in with Babylon, because they held all the strings. Babylon conquered Israel, exiled its leaders. It used its power against God's people. And the prophets prophesy against Babylon because of her arrogance and her cruelty, her idolatry and her opposition to God and his people. In Isaiah chapter 14, let me just read some of it from Isaiah 14. You said in your heart, this is Babylon, I will ascend to heaven. I'll raise my throne above the stars of God. I'll sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. I'll ascend above the tops of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. See, Babylon looked so dominant, so permanent. There was nothing to challenge it, nothing strong enough to rise against it. It looked like it would stay there forever. But actually, at the very heights of its power, in 539 BC, it fell in one night to the Medes and Persians. Military strategy, if you want to go and read up about it, brilliant military strategy. The Medes and Persians, who didn't look like they had a hope, actually took the city. And as the city fell, the whole empire fell into the hands of the Medes and Persians. So to call something Babylon is to evoke all those images, the images of the Tower of Babel, of humans in their arrogance saying, we can dispense with God. We can do it all ourselves. We don't need God. We can make heaven on earth as we work together, use all our ingenuity, all our technology, all our cooperation. It also brings to mind that the absolute cruelty and violence of that kingdom, the way the empire used their power against others, and the way in which if you wanted to get on in that world, you had to smooth up to them. You had to be one of them. You had to come under their power. And if you did, there was wealth to be had. If you got on the right side of Babylon, you could make something for yourself. But an empire that fell, in an hour, it came to nothing. And the city of Babylon was lost in the sands of the Assyrian desert, only dug up in the early 20th century. All those things, the wealth and luxury generated by power, the cruelty, the arrogance, that false feeling that it's eternal, but coming to a swift end. In John's day, who is this Babylon? Well, Babylon, the city, doesn't exist. It's been lost in the sands of the desert. But we're told who it is. Because this lady rides on a beast that has seven heads. And the seven heads, we're told, are seven hills. And in John's day, that's unmistakable. Because the city of Rome, the Babylon of his day, was the city that sat on seven hills. That is what it was known as throughout the ancient world. It is the city on seven hills. This is Rome, the city that symbolised the superpower of his day, intimidating in its power, enticing in its wealth and opulence, who seduces the people and nations and kings of the world to give it loyalty so they too can share some of that power and some of that wealth. There's enough to go round if you get in with Rome. And every world power has been like that. Visited Amsterdam last year. Amsterdam for a while was that sort of city on the world stage. Everything flowed into Amsterdam from what we call Indonesia and other places today. London became that. And many of us, because we come from a British background, that's sort of our home, we don't like to acknowledge the way in which London, the British Empire, was rapacious and corrupt in its wealth. It's slowly coming out, the ways they treated people in Africa, in India, and even the Australian Aboriginals. They say they were bringing civilization. They did bring, well, silver cutlery and stuff like that, but they brought lots of other things with it as well that devastated millions of people's lives. But it's not just London, it's Tokyo, it's New York, it's Moscow, it's Berlin. I don't think Perth is big enough to think that we might become like that, but we dream of it. A world expressing its rejection of God, personified in the great cities of the empires of the world. And whenever an empire rises, it has a city as its core. And the military muscle and the financial might that's projected come from the city, and it dominates. And when a superpower comes, then the choice of everybody in the world is to suck up, fall in line, get into bed, because there's opportunities to make a fortune, join the oppressors, or get crushed under the heel. You've got to choose one way or the other. And this woman sits on a beast. The beast, as I said, we met in Revelation 13, representing political power, a puppet of Satan, of the dragon. Now, some of the details I get fuzzy on. Not quite sure about the seven kings and the eighth one that comes along that's like the others, the ten horns and what they're doing. They represent human kingdoms and kings, some of the backgrounds in Daniel 4 and 7. But the main idea is very clear. The fate of Babylon is destruction. Babylon the Great, the world system that defies God, is doomed. Fallen in just an hour. Not gradual disintegration, but a swift end. So what does that do for us? Well, notice John calls on us to do two things. In chapter 17, verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are the seven hills on which the woman sits. Calls for wisdom to recognise that Rome in his day is this prostitute, this woman, this Babylon. Wisdom is not solving some sort of puzzle, as if you can put it through a computer program. Wisdom is recognising the prostitute for who she really is, and to realise the fate of the prostitute. And if you know something's going to crash and burn, you don't throw your lot in with it, do you? Don't put your shares into billabong at the moment. You'll crash and burn. But if you recognise, what do you do? Well, that's where we come to chapter 18, verse 4. I heard a voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so you will not share in her sin, so you will not receive any of her plagues." Don't share in her evil now. Don't be destroyed with her then. Come out. And notice it's not fight. Let's not go in there and see if you can kill this prostitute. Get your sword out, get your gun out, band together, see what we can do to stop it. It's come out. Because God is the one who will stop it. God is the one who will put the end to corruption. Corruption is too endemic in all of us to get rid of it by just getting rid of something out there. The protest movement, something really good about that. But the movement itself is infected with the same desire for power and wealth as the ones they're protesting against. Now, come out. But what does come out mean? Does it mean become a hermit somewhere? Now, let's all go and create a commune out in the desert somewhere. Then we'll come out. No, because the people John is writing to, they're not actually in Rome. This is not a physical come out. It's a loyalty come out. You can be in the middle of Rome, but not be in Rome. The greatest example, probably the clearest example of that in the Bible, is Daniel. Do you remember Daniel back in the Old Testament? He's one of the exiles in Babylon itself. And through a whole series of circumstances, some outside his control, some he has some say in, he becomes one of the most powerful political figures in Babylon. It's all open for him. If he wants to, he can get in bed with Babylon. He can become one of the wealthiest people in the world. But what does Daniel do? Well, he does the job. He doesn't resign. He does the job, but every day, in front of an open window, he prays to the God of Israel for everyone to see that his loyalty is not to Babylon. He's not in bed with it. His loyalty is to the King of Kings, to the God of Gods, the Creator of heaven and earth. He does his job, but he's not in Babylon. His heart is elsewhere. His hope was in a new city that God would build. I shared a house with a friend when I finished uni. He was a very clever guy, university medal. I started to work for one of the big corporations in Australia. After he'd been working with them, I think it was 9 months, his boss's boss's boss called him into his office and said, "Richard, we're really pleased with you, your work, your progress, the effort you're putting in, and your skills, your capacities. You can go somewhere. And we've laid out for you a career path. It'll mean moving down to Melbourne. In 3 months' time, you'll take up a job there. You'll do that job for 2 years. Then you'll move, I think it was to Queensland, to a sugar mill. You'll become manager of the sugar mill. By the time you're 35, you will be one of the senior managers of this company. And we will give you a very, very low interest loan for you to buy a house wherever you want it. You can borrow almost as much as you like. Your salary when you're 35 will be X." And we came home and we talked about it. And he said, "This is an opportunity I can't miss." But he said, "I'm not sure what it's going to cost, though." And he started to think it through, and he realised that if he moved there, in 10 years' time, the only people who'd be friends in his life would be people in the company. And if he took out the loan, he would be tied to the company till he paid it off 25, 30 years later. They were asking him to sell his soul to the corporation. I'm glad to say he refused it. He still worked for that company for another 20 years. His career path was cut off. He still earned a good living. But that's what's open for many of us. Now, it's not will you or won't you. He still worked. Daniel still worked in Babylon. It's your loyalty. Will you get into bed with the corporations? Will you be part of the corruption? Or will you say, "No, I won't"? And it's scary, isn't it? Because if those corporations are the very people you're hoping to get a job from, why would you sit back? Why would you be a bit nervous about it? Because the world is corrupt. It's in everyone's heart. Babylon is the epitome. It's the crystallisation of all that. But it's no different to the rest of us. No different to a corporation, a government. Come out, says the angel. Let's pray. Lord God, give us the wisdom to see things for what they really are. And give us the confidence in you that their destiny is real, and it would be foolish to get into bed with them. Amen.